4.9, Seattle. Thursday, December 7th, 2006, Pearl Harbor Day. I'm Steve Scherr. This is Weekday. Did the way that dinosaurs breathed allow them to rule the Earth for 65 million years? Scientist Peter Ward hypothesizes that changing atmospheric oxygen levels led to significant evolutionary changes in animals. He says that dinosaurs had a distinct advantage over other creatures during low oxygen eras. He traces this feature back from the birds of today. In a new book, Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmospheres. Peter Ward is a professor of biology, earth and space, astronomy. He studies astrobiology at the University of Washington, co-founder of the Institute for Astrobiology at the UW. He's also author of The End of Evolution and, along with Donald Brownlee, Rare Earth. Thanks for being here again.
Good morning.
Yesterday we talked a lot about climate change and ended on a fairly bleak note with Dave Battiste and Elizabeth Colbert talking about the effects of climate change that we might see, we are seeing already, and that we really will bequeath to our grandchildren, which is not too far from now. So we'll get to that a little later, because we touch on this when we talk about the atmosphere. But let's start with the dim and distant past, if we can, where we have no effect on it, and we can think of it more pleasantly. How did you start thinking about oxygen levels and evolution?
Well, the whole idea that oxygen has gone up and down through time is relatively new. Geologists have had a very difficult time measuring what past oxygen levels were. There isn't any single rock or mineral that you put into a machine and out blinks a number. Today, of course, we now have 21% of our atmosphere is oxygen. So when we talk about higher or lower, we can simply talk about what percent of the atmosphere. And we know now from some indirect methods that the oxygen levels, even as recently as, say, 200 million years ago, were maybe half what they are now, 11%. But if you go back further in the past, they go back up. And sometimes we think at about 300 million years ago, they were much higher than today, 31%. So we're seeing this really huge swing. At 300 million, it's 30%. At 200 million is 10%, and we come up to the modern day, and it's 21%. So those ups and downs seem to be had to have had a big evolutionary effect, and so they seem to have had.
Is this new, this new way of thinking about the evolution of dinosaurs in particular?
Well, nothing's new, I find. Just when you think you've had some great new idea, there it is in the Russian literature. No, it's probably not new, but I've never seen...
Oh, those Russians.
Well, they got everything else. I've never seen anyone ever equate oxygen and dinosaur respiratory systems other than it was always thought that because it seemed to be like the age of dinosaurs was full of jungles, it must have been a super oxygen atmosphere. And that was the thinking in many books. And it's only been in the last two or three years that very good estimates of the oxygen during the age of dinosaurs were present. And now we really have a good sense it was lower entirely during the entire reign of dinosaurs, lower oxygen than today.
Now, if it was a jungly climate, why would it be lower?
Well, the oxygen cycle is extremely complicated. A jungly area
and
would
you
be,
have all of like 5 or 6 minutes to lay it out for us.
Jungles would be great. Lots of oxygen being produced by photosynthesis. And it was thought for a while that the amount of plant life really would tell you how much oxygen is in the atmosphere. But it turns out that it's really how much burning is going on, and not just burning by fire. But oxygen, as we know, is one of the most potent chemicals around, and there's the process called oxidation. Iron rusts, copper oxidizes, and when you burn a match, there's oxygen being consumed. Well, if we have lots and lots of plant life and it dies and it sits on the surface, it oxidizes. Organic matter is one of the most potent ways of actually drawing oxygen out. And so if you have plant life just rotting away, it can actually, if there's enough plant life sitting on the surface, it can draw oxygen out of the atmosphere. Conversely, if you have lots of plant life and you bury it really fast, that oxygen that would have been used for oxidizing that plant material isn't used up. And so this is why we had, at the time of the most luxuriant forest on the planet, the age of coal, when 90% of the Earth's coal happened about 300 million years ago. And these plants, these trees, were pretty new at the game. And at the same time, there were no bacteria yet evolved to break up plant hard material lignin. So plants fell down. They sat on the surface. They didn't break down very quickly. Instead, they got buried really fast. And that rapid burial caused oxygen to rise and rise and rise. 31%. The forest fires of this age of amphibians, this coal age, would have been almost global and pervasive. There would never have been a clear day. Yellow haze, the planet over from space, it would have been this smoky ball.
Wow.
31% oxygen.
Peter Ward is professor of biology, professor of Earth and Space Studies. He looks at astrobiology, which is trying to understand if there and how life would evolve on this planet and others. His new book is Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. So let's just start there since we just left off there. At 30% oxygen, what evolves, what thrives?
30% oxygen would have been a science fiction B-movie fan's greatest friend. When I grew up, there were these fabulous, well, you see them now, they're not fabulous, but when you're a little boy, they were fabulous. The deadly mantis, a great praying mantis that flew around them, about giant ants in the storm drains of Los Angeles, giant spiders, giant flies, giant, this is, you know, arachnid and arthropod heaven. Well, it turns out that high oxygen allows that. Arthropods have a pretty rotten respiratory system. It's just simply a tube, and it's a very thin tube, and it's so thin that it's very difficult for oxygen to diffuse in. One of the reasons that most arthropods are as small as they are is that they are oxygen limited. They have a very hard time. However, if you have very high oxygen, as people have done by putting bugs in high oxygen chambers, they respire much more efficiently. They do wonderfully. If you have 30% oxygen, it turns out the physics alone can tell you, you can have bugs 3 to 5 to 10 times or 100 times bigger than we have today. So the world's biggest insect was probably a dragonfly with a 3-foot wingspan at least. But my favorite bugs were centipedes and millipedes, and I illustrate one of these in the book, up to 6 feet long. Now that's a big bug. That's a bug that could take down a human easily.
6-foot-long centipede.
Yes.
There are some fossils of those?
Oh, yes, lots of fossil records. So imagine the size of the swatter you would need, or would you have to have super raid? I don't know. What does one do with a 6-foot centipede that decides, even though no mammals have yet evolved, gee, this looks good to eat?
Why does life evolve to have to use or to use oxygen?
Oxygen is certainly the most addictive substance on the planet. It's such a corrosive material. We take our first breath and we're hooked on it forever. It's what ultimately kills us. The free radicals, of course, that whole business, we spend our lives trying to eat lean, eat healthy, and stop the ravages of oxygen. It's just a nasty stuff.
What is it doing?
Well, it's the fuel again. It's at least it's not the fuel, but it's letting fuel burn in us. To give a sense of how dangerous it is, there was a series of very beautiful, elegant experiments from a student of the great Robert Berner. Bob Berner at Yale University is the person who came up with these oxygen curves that I feature in the book. And he had a student that said, what would the effect be of raising eggs, alligator eggs, under higher oxygen than today? So he went out and, in great science fashion, egg-napped a bunch of American alligator eggs, didn't get chewed in the process, brought them back, put them in a chamber, and raised oxygen from its normal 21% in steps. So he had some eggs growing at 23%, 25%, 27%, on up to 31%. And with every 2% rise in oxygen, they develop more quickly. So the more oxygen you have, the faster you grow in the egg, and also the larger you are at hatching. Well, because they're growing faster in the egg, they hatch earlier because they get to the point where the egg can't expand anymore and they pop out. So this is all well and good, the higher the oxygen, till you hit 30, 31%. And then what happened is, instead of beautiful little alligators coming out, gargoyles appeared. monsters, monstrous, developmentally ruined little alligator monster reptiles. The high oxygen became so high that it poisoned normal processes of development and caused birth defects, hideous birth defects, and death. So very high oxygen is indeed poisonous. And it makes you wonder, since oxygen was that high, should we expect to see lots of adaptations in animals from that time to deal with very high oxygen? And people are just now beginning to look from a histochemical point of view and from a genetic point of view, because we mammals really come from that time. Our first real ancestors, the mammal-like reptiles, are from high oxygen times.
All right. We're going to come back to all these in detail, but then what were dinosaurs? How did dinosaurs evolve so that they could survive in low oxygen environments?
Well, dinosaurs are the other side of the mark. If giant bugs are a hallmark of high oxygen times, why would there be dinosaurs in low oxygen times? I mean, it seems counterintuitive. During low oxygen, you would think, well, gee, it must be, things might be small. We get giant bugs in high oxygen. Why do we get giant reptile-like things in low oxygen? Well, it turns out that the earliest dinosaurs were not giant at all. These are very thin, gracile things. And although they might be 3 feet tall, perhaps a little taller, they're very thin. They're very thin-limbed. So the very most primitive of these dinosaurs are bipedal. But the answer to that whole question is fascinating. Everybody really hones in on what killed the dinosaurs. And I mean, every school kid mourns their passing, of course. And now we know most famously that asteroid did it. But why were there dinosaurs in the first place is a question not often asked. And I submit that it is because of the low oxygen that the dinosaur body plan, which is originally was bipedal like a tiny T-Rex, is an adaptation for low oxygen in two ways. Well, first and most simply, the bipedalism, lizards have a hard time running and breathing. This is called Carrier's constant. And most lizards, fence lizards, will run and stop and breathe really fast. And then they run because they can't take deep breaths when they run. A lizard body does a figure S as it runs. It's sinuous. And as its body carries over, it compresses one half of the chest back and forth. Now, if you go up on a bipedal nature, that front leg, which is doing the compressing, isn't there anymore. So bipedalism is a tremendous adaptation for breathing. So that's part one.
All right. Hold for part two. We'll take a break and we'll get part two. Peter Ward has written Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from Epiphany School in Madrona. For 49 years, children pre-kindergarten through grade 5 have gained knowledge from experienced faculty and a challenging academic program. Campus tours for prospective families available. Details online at epiphanyschool.org.
Coming up later this morning on KUOW, we debate whether other countries have a case for prosecuting Bush administration officials for war crimes. That's on To the Point at 11 this morning. And then exactly 65 years after Japan bombed the U.S., we're going to compare and contrast life in the military then and now. That's on Day Today at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony at Benaroya Hall, presenting Handel's Messiah December 14th through the 17th, and on December 12th, An Irish Christmas with Eileen Ivers and Immigrant Soul. Tickets and information at 206-215-4747 or seattlesymphony.org.
Next hour, we're going to look at healthcare practice in America and whether some healthcare practices, or actually why some healthcare practices, do more harm than good. This hour, we're looking at the evolution of life on the planet, evolution of dinosaurs. Peter Ward is a professor of Earth and Space Studies and biology, astrobiology. He's written Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. One of the influential writers working out of the UW, I so declare. All right, so part one was the way they scurried across and compressed their sacks.
So part two goes back to actually a story I read about These poor mountaineers on top of Mount Everest looking up and seeing way up above them, to their surprise, geese, flying birds. And in fact, barheaded geese, which is a common species around the Himalayas, has been tracked up to 35,000 feet. Everest is at 29. Now, any human on top of Everest, any good mammal on top of Everest, is either dying or will soon die without oxygen. You just, in that thin air, you just can't do it. And so I titled the book sort of the takeoff on John Krakauer's book, which is Into Thin Air. And I wanted to come out of thin air because those birds are even in thinner air. Birds have a radically different respiratory system than we do. It was such a surprise to me when I learned this, that they don't have our nice system, a very simple set of lungs where we breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. They have developed a second auxiliary set of lungs, if you will, called air sacs. And they also have, instead of, we have this trachea where air goes in, air goes out, the same tube, they have a non-recirculating, so it comes in one tube and goes separated, goes out in other. And it takes two entire breaths to get one breath of gas all the way through the system. We breathe in, we breathe out. They breathe in, they breathe in a second time, pushing the first one from the auxiliary gas sacs into the true lungs and then out. You've got twice the time to cleanse out the oxygen. So if a bird were sitting here between you and me, Steve, it would be 30% more efficient at extracting oxygen out of this room. However, if we were having this interview at 5,000 feet, the bird would be 200% more efficient. The bird lungs are
because of our inefficiency.
Our inefficiency, exactly. Bird lungs are exquisite at dealing with low oxygen. So the next step was dinosaur paleontologists were confronted with these strange hollowed out openings in the bones. And some anatomists put two and two together and noticed that the bones in, or the holes in the bones in dinosaurs were exactly the same shape and place of holes in bones of birds where they stuffed these auxiliary air sacs. Identical. So finally in Nature in 2005, two people finally exactly matched up the same bones, birds and dinosaurs, a whole variety of dinosaurs. And either it's the most amazing coincidence in the world, or dinosaurs had the air sac system. Well, it makes perfect sense. Birds are dinosaurs. They evolved from dinosaurs. And so they just had this beautiful air sac system given to them by dinosaurs who evolved that in the face of the lowest oxygen of the last 500 million years.
All right, so how did the planet have that such a low amount of oxygen at that point? What had happened?
Yeah, so that's the sort of the nastiest turn of this whole story. Everybody wants to know, is it going to happen again? Well, the answer is yes, but the again might be way off in the future, but then again, it may not. But that's the second part. But this low oxygen is probably a consequence of all the continents which pushed together. And we had this single gigantic continent called Pangaea. North America, Africa, Asia, they all coalesced into one giant landmass. And as in any large landmass, the centers of it are always drier. It's where you get the coast, the coastal forests, the coastal rainforests. But once you have a big interior, you get deserts. So the world at that time had produced the greatest desert of the planet. The amount of plant material on the planet was drastically reduced and lowered. But because it was so big, it was dry. And plant material that would fall down there wouldn't get buried. It would sit out there and rot in the oxygen and let every bit of its organic material finally grab off more oxygen molecules. So the very low 10% oxygen was a consequence of this huge supercontinent that only began to break up about 200, 190 million years ago when oxygen started to go up.
So you have this huge continent. Is that why we had, is that when the petrified, is there any petrified forest connection there? Is that what?
The petrified forest in Arizona is exactly the time that the first dinosaurs appeared, that the oxygen was at a minimum, and that things started to spread apart.
I see. So dinosaurs evolved from what at this point?
Well, there's a lot of sort of reptilian-like things running around, but the exact ancestor of the dinosaurs, they share an ancestor with crocodiles. So there's a crocodile lineage that goes off one way, and these little bipedal creatures that we call the earliest dinosaurs go a different way. The crocs keep their very primitive lung system, but very soon after the split, we get these fossil indications that we have this air sac system.
And before that, there was a high oxygen
apart, right?
The Silurian, Devonian, and these are when these first creatures started creeping out of the seas.
Yeah, the high oxygen is wonderful because any sort of really nasty, primitive, not very good lung system is going to work great. And one of the really interesting findings that we came up with when doing this book was that I began to compare the rate at which new species form in high oxygen conditions and low oxygen conditions. And interestingly enough, it's low oxygen that drives innovation and radical changes because things are dying and you're dying. Natural selection only works if lots of things die. However, under high oxygen, it's as if everybody's rich. You know, oxygen's like money, and you can have any crummy pair of sort of half-good lungs and you're going to be fine. You know, it's just there's so much free money out there that you survive. So it's the low oxygen times that really make evolution get going and build new stuff.
I just like this image of the rich, crummy creatures wandering around the Silurian Devonian age.
Just breathing. Yes.
What was happening in the oceans? What's the oceans part of this cycle?
The oceans mimic the oxygen in the atmosphere because all this oxygen percentage is atmospheric. It's not a perfect one-to-one, for instance. We have 21% oxygen today, and most of our oceans are oxygenated. But look at some place like the Black Sea. The surface of it is oxygenated, but the reason they call it the Black Sea is that its bottom has no oxygen. And it is black because all the organic material that is falling down there is not finding any oxygen, so it is not oxidizing. It's reduced carbon. I mean, reduced carbon is absolutely necessary for our society. That's what we put into our cars when we burn coal. That's what it is. Reduced carbon has full of energy. It just needs to combine with oxygen to release that energy. So oceans today are almost all, except for that one exception, oxygenated. But it is when oceans go anoxic, and we go back to that Triassic, that oceans turn into planet killers, and they are an anoxic ocean is the most dangerous thing that a planet can confront other than a very large asteroid.
What happens? What's going on?
Anoxic oceans can only occur if you have heat that's the same from the pole to the tropics. I mean, the reason we have wind today is we have a cold pole, we have a warm tropics. The reason we have ocean currents, heat is being redistributed around the globe. So that warm tropical water is being exported north or south, that warm tropical air, same thing, they mix around. But if you have a polar region, Arctic, Antarctic, as almost as warm as the tropical latitudes, nothing is pushing. There's no energy to. You don't have to redistribute heat. It's already redistributed. When that happens, the ocean currents slow down. When that happens, the bottoms of the oceans go anoxic or no oxygen.
Because there's no churn?
No churn at all. And that creates conditions that we've only discovered in the last couple of years that appear to be very, very deadly, even beyond what the craziest science fiction people had imagined in the past.
The oceans are releasing toxics? What's happening?
Yeah, when you have a low oxygen, if you go to the bottom of the Black Sea, you will find a lot of really nasty bacteria. Well, you find them in any ocean. But in the Black Sea, the conditions are such that there's a lot of bacteria that are dealing with sulfur in their everyday lives. And one group that's dealing with sulfur is metabolizing compounds and producing, just as a waste product, a gas called hydrogen sulfide, H2S. When I took chemistry at the University of Washington years ago, we had a H2S lab, and you go home, you have that rotten egg smell because that's what that stuff is. It's exceedingly toxic. And so we had to supposedly have lots of care and conditions. Of course, we freshmen were squirting H2S at everybody. And they finally closed it down because I think someone died. The toxicity was like way over the top. H2S is a very nasty, 200 parts per million will kill a human. So this is something that's at very low concentrations. If you have enough of these bacteria at the bottom, H2S is produced in large volumes. It comes out of solution into the atmosphere. And 2 years ago, in this past year, several groups of scientists have suggested that the Permian extinction, the mother of all mass extinctions, the Great Dying, was caused not by an impact from space, but by hydrogen sulfide that was a product of global warming, rapid global warming.
Really?
Rapid global warming.
Yeah.
H2S.
Yeah.
SUV. H2S SUV.
All right. We're going to get more into that. Two questions on that. And then I also invite you to, if you have questions for Peter Ward or comments, 206-543-5869 is our number. 1-800-289-5869. Or you can email us weekday@kuow.org.
how many extinctions? What are the number of mass extinctions that we've
Well, there's 14, 13, but there's the big five. There's five really biggies. And that was in the Ordovician 400 million years ago. There was one at 360 million years ago. The biggest at 250, another big one at 200, and then the dinosaur killer 65 million years ago.
And what were the causes? What do they now think? What do you now think the causes of those extinctions were?
Well, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I would have said asteroid impact. We certainly know that the dinosaur killer was a 10 kilometer or larger asteroid coming out from space, hitting in what is now the Yucatan Peninsula area called the Chicxulub Crater. But we would have said at the same time, well, gee, if one was caused by that, why not all of them? It's a very simple, elegant, sweet hypothesis. It's not messy at all. Explosion, things die. But lots of people have been looking at these other mass extinction boundaries and finding none of the hallmarks, the evidence left behind by large body impact. You can't hit the Earth with a huge rock from space without leaving evidence of it. And it is the material of the asteroid itself, iridium and platinum group elements, but it's also the effect of the shock hitting the planet. It deforms minerals. It causes a great deal of soot and gas and dust to be thrown up into the atmosphere and come back down as a layer, an impact layer. We can't find any of these impact layers any place except at the KT of 65 million years ago. So now we're left with a bunch of dead bodies and no murder weapon, if you will. So people have been scratching their heads, and my fraternity going out, and this is the most reasonable new hypothesis out there, that death by global warming and death by hydrogen sulfide.
How quick?
Well, where the warming come from is the question. That goes back to the how quick. The warming in each of these cases, each of these mass extinctions is associated with what is called a flood basalt. And we in Washington State only need to go to eastern Washington to see the huge volume of Columbia River basalts, that brown rock that tracks all the way from the middle of the state to Spokane and all the way into Idaho and the Snake River Canyon and down to Oregon. So we have a huge portion of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington covered by hundreds of feet of lava basalt. When that occurred, which the extrusions were 30 million years ago, when that occurred, a great deal of gas went into the atmosphere too, and the primary volcanic gas is carbon dioxide. Now we're finding the same sort of flood basalt associated with four of the five mass extinctions, only far more basalt than we have in the Columbia River basalts. The largest ever is associated with what we call the Siberian Traps in Russia. A huge area of Siberia is covered by lava. It all came out in a short period around 250 million years ago, the same time we had the greatest extinction in Earth history.
So those are all moving at a pace. Still in geological time.
Still in geological. You know, we're not going to see wake up 3 days from now and be gasping for H2S. These are events that are taking place probably over hundreds of thousands of years. But because it's such a hundreds of thousands of years sounds like an awfully long time, unless you're trying to look back, say, 200 million years and track that. It's very difficult to parse down time when it's a long time ago. But increasingly now we're seeing that these heating events, because that's what happens. You heat the atmosphere, you cause circulation to slow down, and when circulation slows down, it allows these nasty bacteria to take over the oceans. I mean, it's a really amazing sort of worldview associated with these H2S-producing bacteria, are bacteria which love to eat H2S, and they're purple. And so our vision now during these mass extinctions is of a world ocean that's bright purple in color. So from space, you would see not blue oceans, but purple oceans.
Peter Ward has written Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. We'll take some of your calls as well at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org. Stan's in Sultan. Hi, Stan. Stan?
I'm curious if birds are such efficient.
I don't have any headphones.
If birds are so well in low oxygen, what's the deal with the canary in the coal mine?
So what's the deal with the canary in the coal mine if birds are such efficient producers of low oxygen, at low oxygen?
Well, it isn't oxygen that kills the canary in the coal mine. It's generally other gas that kills you. Canaries in coal mines were there to detect swamp gas, and this is the self-same hydrogen sulfide. Because they are so efficient at taking in oxygen, very small quantities of other toxic gas, which would be methane, high carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and hydrogen sulfide, are taken into the bird system more rapidly than in us, and it knocks them off quicker.
Does that answer it? Yeah, I guess it does. All right, that answers it. 206-543-5869 is our number, 1-800-289-5869. He may perhaps did not like your answer. Jason writes, Vine Deloria talked in his book Red Earth, White Lies about how the greatly varying CO2 levels in the atmosphere caused by changing sea levels could affect the thyroid gland production in animals, leading to very rapid change in body size or giantism over the course of just a generation or two. Any thoughts on that?
I've never heard that hypothesis. The thing about carbon dioxide is we talk about it as being, you know, lots of it. But we're talking about something in parts per million. There's very few of those carbon dioxide molecules floating around. I do know that people are now trying to grow insects at high and low carbon dioxide to see exactly just what is the effects of changing CO2. I must profess I don't know that. I'll go look it up. Sounds interesting.
Where do you, when you look back in time and you look at the creatures that have been there, are there particular creatures that best, you know, individual creatures that best sort of pinpoint the ideas you're talking about?
Yeah, there are.
Low oxygen and high oxygen, I guess.
There's lots of animals that we really see seem to thrive at times of both high oxygen and low oxygen. We mammals, for instance, are really good at pretty high oxygen because we have pretty inefficient lungs. And so the age of dinosaurs comes to an end at about that time. Oxygen is at about 21%, and then it goes even higher, 23, 24%, just when mammals are really taking off after the extinction of dinosaurs. But my favorite are dealing with the oceans. My first favorite, greatest love scientifically was the chambered nautilus. And it turns out that after every one of these mass extinctions or around them, we find deposits filled with ammonites, which are totally extinct cephalopods. They had a beautiful external shell. And they, like the nautilus, are like a squid in a shell. They had chambered shells and they could float around. But the exquisite thing about these things, and what I hadn't really thought about, is that they have the most efficient lung system of all. They have jet propulsion. They suck in water like an octopus. When they pull in this water, it goes over their gills and then is blown back out. The volume coming in, going out, though, means that they have the very large gills are washed in enormous volumes of water.
All right, we'll come back to that. Peter Ward's our guest. We're talking about the Earth and its ancient atmospheres on Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, uniting the expertise of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Children's Hospital and Regional Medical Center to form the Northwest's federally designated Comprehensive Cancer Center. Information online at seattlecca.org.
KUOW and Center Stage present A Christmas Carol, a new version of the immortal holiday classic, featuring 18 Old English and European carols, November 25th through December 23rd, at Knutson Family Theater in Federal Way. For more information, visit our community page at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the UC Berkeley Columbia Executive MBA program with faculty from two major business schools. Classes are held at UC Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area and at Columbia in New York City. Details on an upcoming information session in Seattle at berkeley.columbia.edu.
Next time on Open Source, the brain science of music, making sense of perfect pitch, how tunes get stuck in our heads, why songs can seem familiar on first listening, and asking, was this most sublime human expression a leg up in the long competitive struggle of evolution? I'm Christopher Lydon. Join the conversation about your mind on music right now at radioopensource.org. And tune into Open Source from PRI.
You can hear Open Source tonight at 9 o'clock on KUOW.
Next hour, we're looking at healthcare. This hour, we're looking at the Earth's atmosphere. Out of Thin Air, Peter Ward's book. Peter Ward's professor of biology, professor of Earth and Space Studies, and adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington, co-founder of the Institute for Astrobiology at the University of Washington. He has published 12 books, including The End of Evolution, and this new one as well.
an email and a phone call asking the same question based on something that was on NPR this morning. Sherry's in her car. Sherry, you go first. I'll read the email to follow up. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, this morning while getting ready, I just heard that scientists have been watching the Earth's oceans, that they're getting bluer instead of greener. So the plant life is either dying or not growing. And I was listening to this thinking that's pretty alarming considering the salinity in the oceans and just that it's the oxygen that it gives off. I was wondering if you could comment on that as far as how that works with our atmosphere.
Yeah, and Paul said the same thing in his email. He says, is this a sign or potential cause of the onset of the anoxic ocean you mentioned? Might this indicate that this may occur sooner rather than later?
Well, we only have to go to Hood Canal to see a model of what a warmed planet's oceans look like. And we're having, as we know, these catastrophic die-offs. Oxygen minimum levels are every year now, every summer when it warms up a little bit, and all the people lining the shores, which are the proximate problem, are flushing their septics right into Hood Canal. So you've got this organic material and warm water. It eats up all the oxygen. And once it goes to a minimum value, all life down there dies around it. You can certainly cause the ocean to get bluer if you kill the material in it, and in most cases, very low oxygen can do that. We have enormous now low oxygen zones growing in the Gulf of Mexico, and these are square miles or more of just dead zones, and they move around. They're like big water masses, warm, no oxygen.
We have one off the Oregon coast.
Yes.
Well, how does this relate? I know, as you'll say, this relates to the second part of the second book that's coming out of this, but how does this relate to what we see happening with the carbonification of the ocean, with the oceans getting slightly more acidic?
Yeah, the oceans are saving our bacon, if you will, from the amount of carbon dioxide that we humans and the volcanoes, well, just as a caveat, you know, we always blame the SUVs. Well, the volcanoes are equally to blame. If we could figure out some way to hit the volcanic off switch, we could drive as much as we ever want. But in the absence of that, there will always be naturally produced carbon dioxide. And you know, it's a misnomer to say it's all human produced. It's not. But we're adding to something that's going to naturally happen anyway. And the oceans absorb an awful lot of the excess carbon dioxide. The oceans draw it out. It dissolves in the oceans. But as that happens, it causes, as a natural chemical byproduct, the oceans to become more acidic. More carbon dioxide can dissolve in cold water than warm, and therefore it's the Arctic and Antarctic oceans which take up more carbon dioxide. And as they do this, they become more acidic. Now, the scariest aspect is that pteropods, which are a small mollusk at the base of the food chain in the Arctic, are now living in waters sufficiently acidic to start rotting their calcium carbonate shells. So they're dissolving away in acid. They're the base of the food chain, and this is where a lot of the specialists working on Arctic oceans are extremely alarmed.
But we're having these sort of conflicting or parallel or overlapping cycles, because we also, you talked about a warming of the oceans at the same time.
Well, the oceans are warming, certainly, but they're still cooler at the poles than they are in the tropics. So now, as we still have a cooler pole, we are taking up more CO2 up there. But all the oceans will increase in acidity as time goes on. And this is an increasingly alarming process that people are now just now looking at.
Is there a relationship between the oxygen levels and the carbon dioxide levels in the ocean?
There's the geochemical cycles, because that's what they are, that control carbon dioxide content and control oxygen content, are largely independent. However, they seem to be go in different directions. In the past, when carbon dioxide has been very high, it leads to low oxygen conditions, or there have been low oxygen conditions, more correctly. And when carbon dioxide has been very low, it's been time of high oxygen conditions. Right now, we have historically extremely low carbon dioxide compared to the last 500 million years. And we have, for the last 500 million years, relatively high oxygen levels. Now, the spooky thing is we're heading towards high CO2 again. Does that mean that the natural cycles will start dropping oxygen levels? and the science isn't progressed to the point where we can make an accurate prediction. But if we use the past as key, the answer is yes.
So birds may be okay.
Birds would be fine.
Josh writes, I had always thought that the evolution of photosynthesis triggered the planet's great mass extinction by releasing all that toxic oxygen. Is that not true?
Well, it certainly caused the first great mass extinction, which was happened when, you're right, when the oxygenation of the atmosphere had happened. All life up that time had been anoxic. And here comes these oxygen molecules. I mean, they don't do it in a huge rush. They're just gradually taking place. And as this happens, though, at about 2.5 billion years ago, lineage after lineage does go extinct or is driven to places where oxygen can't find it. And that's where these H2S bacteria live. They go down to the bottoms of oceans that are low oxygen anyway, or they go down in a mud. Go to any beach and dig down 6 inches and you find a black layer that smells like rotten eggs. Well, that's the no oxygen, hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria are all around us, just hiding, waiting.
And Wayne writes, I had recently read about the discovery of large asteroid craters discovered in the oceans. One apparently is located in the Chesapeake Bay area. Would this have the same effect as one hitting the land areas?
Yeah, great question. And the Chesapeake Bay crater certainly seems like a relatively big crater, but relative is important in asteroid hits. There was no major mass extinction associated with that Chesapeake hit, which I think was about 35, 36 million years ago. It's very much smaller than the crater, for instance, left behind by the dinosaur killer. That crater is 200 kilometers in diameter. Chesapeake Bay crater, I think, is only 40. And so it doesn't scale linearly the amount of violence from an impact. So the small craters, they certainly would have been noticed, but they don't cause mass extinctions.
Hmm. Judith is in Marysville. Hello, Judith.
Hello.
Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Peter, first of all, I want to congratulate you on your on the honor of the three lectures that you just did at Princeton. That was really wonderful.
What were those? I don't think we know about those. What was the honor?
Well, actually, I had to postpone them until 2 weeks from now, but thank you. Is this Judith Chandler?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
I just had a few health bumps, and so I'm actually going to go out there in about 3 more weeks.
Oh, that's good.
But what's the honor? You get to go to Princeton, and do they have a specific name?
The Stafford White Lectures.
Just tooting your horn a little bit.
There we go. Thank you.
All right. So, Judith, go ahead.
Anyway, I was wondering, this is in your previous book when you were in the Karoo and you were looking around at those red hills and, you know, you kind of came up with some ideas on, you were thinking about Mars and the redness of Mars and then the red hills and the Karoo and the big die-off when a lot of the, I can't remember the name of that dinosaur.
All those Mamluk reptiles, all those Gorgons, yes. And
yeah,
that's
all the Gorgons, yes.
So this is really when in the evolution of my thinking when I really started thinking about oxygen as that was about 4 years ago when that was written, and that was the start of the journey that led to this book.
That's what I was thinking.
And in what way? What was the process?
Well, at the time, none of us really knew what caused these mass extinctions, but we knew that oxygen somehow had to be associated with this. And it was only about 4 years ago that really refined new curves of oxygen through time started coming out. It's so new, this science. It's complex modeling, and again, this Robert Berner of Yale University is in the forefront of this. But as these new curves came out, there's just the realization, not only by me, but by lots of people, that we had really underestimated how important respiration is in evolution. I mean, you think about it. How long do you go between drinking, or how long do you go between eating, and then how long do you go between you have to take a breath? As in terms of biological processes, respiration can cause death quicker than anything else, and so it is going to be, I think, the major driver of natural selection.
Hmm. Judith, thanks a lot. All right, one more question more broadly, and then back to that point before we're out of time. Cypress writes, and we had a phone call as well. If one wants to be involved with or study climate, atmospheric change, where do they begin? Could you recommend your favorite books, movies, or reports on the subject?
Well, the best place to begin is actually probably listening to Steve yesterday. One of my great heroes, David Battisti from the University of Washington, was here. The best way to keep up on the latest climate without non-politicized, the scientific consensus of where we are is a website called realclimate.org. I have nothing to do with this, but I'm certainly read it as often as I can. I think it's the best place. It's where the professional climate change people go to exchange ideas and to talk about this and that. For instance, the most wonderful scathing review of Michael Crichton's crazy book about, you know, the global warmers are trying to take over the planet is in there. But that's the place to go, I think, to keep abreast of what's happening. And it's done in real person language, not science speak.
Realclimate.org?
Yep.
All right. And also, just the second half of her email was, I just got accepted into the University of Washington for my final year and a half to study climate change. I'm overwhelmed in which aspect to approach these studies. Which is better? Environmental science, astrobiology, biochemistry?
Well, just go find the one that you find yourself reading the most about, because the stuff that interests you the most is where your heart says you have to go. Just follow that. I think we should always follow our interests. I was studying to be something other than a paleontologist and finally realized there will be no jobs. I'll never have a job. I'll never have a career, but I love paleontology, so I'll go there. You have to follow that, I think.
All right. Let me take you back to what you said about how important respiration is to evolution. How quickly, I mean, we're talking about a relatively slow change in time, right, for the oxygen levels and the carbon dioxide levels to change. So what's your sense of how these animals were evolving? I mean, are you able to find in the fossil record the stages?
Well, yeah, I think one of the best examples of this of all is watching how tetrapods, which are the four-legged vertebrates, evolved out of fish. We really have a beautiful scenario now, a beautiful sequence of change in which we can track now as how these fish-like creatures, certainly they had fins, but we have the first real tetrapods, something called ichthyostega, that occurs about 363 million years ago. But what I did in the book, and actually published in the scientific literature 2 weeks ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we just looked at the fossil record of those amphibians, the fish that became amphibians and climbed out. And then for the first time, looked at the fossil record of arthropods. It wasn't just fish climbing out at the time. It turns out at the same time, we had spiders and scorpions, the first insects, centipedes, also climbing out of the ocean and colonizing the land. They did so because of the first big peak in oxygen. It rises to way over 23-24%. And again, any creature crawling out of the sea doesn't have a fully formed lung. Evolution never builds anything right away. It's a long, slow process, and the first iterations of it don't work very well. My sense is that there's really an astrobiological consequence to this, that let's say we have a somewhat Earth-like planet. It's got oceans. It's got animals in the oceans, but it has atmospheric oxygen that never gets above 10%. Well, you can still live, and it turns out it's a lot easier to get oxygen out of water than out of air. Just the physics of the whole system, you can extract it. So if you have a 10% oxygen world over an ocean, you may never get lungs good enough to let the creatures crawl out. So you may have this whole world where there's never an animal on the surface in air. It just never got high enough.
What would be, given that we're working on evolution and natural selection, what would be the motivation for a creature to leave the ocean?
Ah, good thing. Why do you ever go anywhere? Well, quite often it's to find mates. Gee, if there are more of my kind out there. But quite often there's two other reasons. One might be food. And the world of 400 million years ago, plants were colonizing the surface like crazy. Plants are a great food resource. Nobody's out there eating them. So somebody should go out, eat the plants, or eat the scavengers on the plants. I mean, a lot of animals eat bacteria. So that's one possibility. But another really good possibility is that the oxygen did it. Once again, a lot of these creatures at the time, these fish were living in stagnant pools in which seasonally they would be going to drought. That's where lungfish live. They go bury themselves down. But a stagnant pool can have oxygen levels that drop down to zero. Whereas if you can breathe even a little bit of air, you're going to survive. So we find a lot of fish today, mudskippers and the like, that sit half in water, half out, and absorb through their gills oxygen, but also have very primitive sort of gulping lungs and do both.
Oh, really? That's what they're doing when we see them on the sides of waters. They're actually getting they're getting oxygen from a variety of places.
Yeah, there's over 100 kinds of fish apparently in the world today that have some primitive form of getting oxygen as well as from water through as well as primitive lungs. So creatures keep doing this. Let's get out.
All right. Last phone call before we're out of time. Dan's in Snohomish. Hi, Dan.
Oh, good morning. It's a pleasure to be on the air. Thank you. I saw a show, one of the more interesting shows I've seen lately. I believe it was on Nova, about global dimming, how pollution in the atmosphere is actually keeping things artificially cooler than they might otherwise be. And I was wondering how that relates to, the geologic situations that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great question. Everything's a balance, of course. The processes that are causing that global dimming, so much dust in the atmosphere, for instance, certainly are going to cause less sunlight to hit the planet. When less sunlight hits, the planet doesn't get as hot. On the other hand, the same processes throwing up the dust and material is also, in all probability, putting carbon dioxide up there. So we have one process, the dimming, that causes us to cool. Another process, the greenhouse effect, that causes us to warm, and unfortunately, dimming is losing to greenhouse gases.
Dan, thanks a lot. All right, so you said this is a two-part, there's a second part of your thinking evolving. If out of thin air is looking at oxygen and oxygen levels in creatures, what's the second part?
Well, this was the fun one. This is looking, who doesn't want to write about dinosaurs? So I let my inner paleontologist out and really got to do a dino book. But part two is the carbon dioxide through time, and this is a much more grim picture, and it is one that has huge implications for our own world. And again, I worked with David Battisti in trying to come up with some estimates on what we might expect over the next 100 years, next 1,000 years, next 10,000 years. And if CO2 continues to rise at its present course, we will have within 100, at most 200 years, levels that we last saw 60 million years ago at the Eocene when we had crocodiles at the poles. So within a century, we're going to do what it took 60 million years to come out of. So that shows you how unbelievably abnormal the rise in CO2 is. Nothing in past history has ever been like this.
But it also is implications for food production, also implications for just what may or may not survive and how the larger cycle, how this cycle may affect the larger bodies, oceans.
Oh, totally. Short term, CO2 makes more plants. I mean, everybody says, oh, CO2 is terrible. Well, plants grow faster, do better. But do the food crops do better? And here's where we have to worry. Will we have as much cereal and grain production in a world where we have 1,000 ppm carbon dioxide as we do now? There's a lot of important grains that need a cold snap if you never have it.
All right, we'll leave it there. Until next time, when you tell us about that book. Peter Ward's latest book is Out of Thin Air. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you for your phone calls and your emails. KUOW 94.9 Seattle, Thursday, December 7th, 2006.
It's just about 10 o'clock at KUOW-FM, 94.9 Seattle, KUOW-AM 1340, Tumwater, Olympia, NPR News and Information. Good morning, I'm Ken Vincent. Coming up next on Weekday, do we need all of the new advanced medical procedures and technology that is causing the cost of healthcare to skyrocket? Let's get a traffic report. Here's Harmon Shea.
Well, we're still trying to clear out northbound 5 in Tacoma, but it's tough going because two lanes are still blocked, two lanes open northbound at 56. The earlier fatal accident, they're working on it, and the backups are improving a little, but that's not much help if you're caught in the backup, which starts around 272nd. Exit's quite snarled there as well. A lot of people bailing out in disgust. As for closer to the Seattle area, we still have 520 slow from I-5 out to the water. Westbound was cleared up, and now we've just had an accident at the east high-rise in the left lane. I-90 might be the better way to go if you're headed east or west right now. Also, some slowing headed into downtown Seattle on I-5. The Mercer exit backed up, apparently with construction at the bottom of the exit. This report is service of Polygon Northwest Homes. I'm Harmon Shea for KUOW.
Thank you, Harmon.
Programming on KUOW is supported by the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and SeattlePI.com. In print, online, anytime.
The weather forecasters say areas of fog clearing away to mostly cloudy skies, temperatures around or above 50. Right now, we're starting to see some sun at 10 o'clock.